offering humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, being joined by Arpind of Team Radio Sai. We are with you for this week's afternoon satsang. Though we call it an afternoon, it's barely appearing like an afternoon. Oh, wonderful weather out here, a gentle drizzle outside. The weather is as beautiful as it can be. So it is our pleasure today to join you yet again for an afternoon satsang. And if you are regularly listening to our series, you will know that this week it's back to that exciting Satyam Shivam Sundaram series. And before we go on with what we're going to talk to you about today, let me join you all in welcoming Arvind. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem. You know, you made a reference to the rains that were on outside. It often triggers this thought in me, you know. Just about 2-3 months back, we were all struggling under the onslaught of the heat, and there seemed to be no water. In fact, I remember even for our building, they had to drill an extra bore because the groundwater in our bore had gone dry. Mm-hmm. We were at about 60 feet underground, and we had to dig a new bore which went 210 feet underground to get water. And, you know, I think we discussed this in one of the satsangs where almost miraculously, it is nothing short of a miracle, where on the day, the evening, the night before the Ganesha immersion, there was such rain and the Chitravati river started flowing. And now, you know, if we see the newspapers, they all state how terrible the rain has been, how damaging it has been, and, you know, people are praying for the times when rains can stop. Due to excessive rains, there are vegetables that are rotting. And, you know, I just wonder what a predicament God might be in. You know, 3 months back, they said that what we want is like a hurricane, a thunderstorm. We want a lot of rain. And God answers the prayers. And now you say, you know, God, enough. We don't want rain. We want sunshine. We want sunshine. This is where I think that a blend between God's grace and human effort has to come in. As was rightly pointed out by, you know, Chakravarti sir of the Central Trust, he had said that if we take a 4-year period or a 5-year period, the rains have been constant from ages. Mm-hmm. And in fact have been gradually increasing. Okay, but what happens is these annual changes. 1 year it is less, 1 year it is terribly less, 1 year it is more, the other it is terribly more. Overall, over 5 years, the annual rainfall on an average is the same.
Right.
And that's what he observed. But here we are complaining, you know, it's almost like life, what happens, you know. Our life overall is, you know, when planned, God plans our life in such a manner that we always move towards the ultimate goal of our life, and our life is peaceful and contented. But within that, there are ups and downs. And spirituality is all about balancing out those ups and downs and remaining equanimous. I feel our physical efforts also should be in this regard. You know, this middle path, this equanimity where I think India is probably the only country that has two regions, one suffering from drought, one suffering from flood simultaneously. Or in two periods of time, one period the same region having a drought and in a few months later the same region having a flood. I think human effort should go into even this in balancing out, just as it is even in our, you know, spiritual journeys. This leveling out and evening out, balancing, is what is most important. Now, why I went into this apparent digression is because when we have, you know, a look at a lot of Swami's photographs taken during the year that we are speaking about now, which is 1948. We just completed 1947, mm-hmm. and we're into 1948. We see, though it is not officially recorded anywhere as such, but we see that between 1947 to 1948, there's a quite dramatic change in Swami's appearance. Swami appears a little more thinner, more gaunt, and apparently having lost quite some weight. So 1948 was a slightly quiet period because for almost 3 to 4 months in 1948, Swami did nothing but, in quotes, rest at Doddamane Sakamma's home in Bangalore. But you know, it would be amazing when we discuss 1948 to see that in spite of this being a quiet year, a year of rest because Swami had some illness, which is not actually documented, it is still so filled with activity, and the number of things that happened in 1948, one can just never imagine that a person not in the pink of his health or the peak of his physical constitution would be able to manage the kind of things that Swami managed in 1948.
And having said that, you know, we will come to that later of how what was happening with Swami in the fronts of Swami's health. And the very profound explanation which Swami gave that and the parallels which Swami drew with other avatars.
Mm-hmm.
But as you said, one thing which Swami had mentioned before is that, you know, the demarcation of 16 years in Swami's life.
Correct.
This also proved to be a time where, you know, there was a difference in the kind of activity Swami did.
Mm.
As we saw, 1947 was the time when Swami gave his first discourse. And in the 50s, we'll see that wherever Swami goes, that would be one of the important things that he did. He would always give an upadesh, he would always give a discourse. And that will be the central event of a visit to any place. Though Swami was continuing those individual house visits, spending time with families, spending time with extended families, that became an important aspect of every visit of Swami.
Correct. You know, actually, if we see the demarcation that Swami has done, it was said that the first 16 years of life, of Swami's life, would be leelas. The next 16 would be mahimas. And the third 16 years would be the upadesh. You know, so according to that, it coincides with 16 plus 16, 32. 32 to 48. So when Swami physically turned 32, that is much later, that was when even, you know, the Sanatana Sarathi and other such things came into being.
Right, right.
Yeah, you know, and the discourses went on to a new high. A new high in the sense, in the terms of quantity, the number of discourses that Swami gave,
yes,
was on a rise.
You see the early 50s,
mm.
there are some discourses where Swami would go to a particular village, speak to the farmers there.
Mm.
So all the examples that Swami would give would be relating to farming, sowing seeds, harvesting. You know, it was definitely a spiritual discourse. There's no doubt about that. Swami would never dilute his agenda. But it was for specific groups. You know, there were discourses Swami would give school children on inaugurating his new building. Or Swami would give weavers. Swami would go into a weaver community and give examples pertaining to them. But when Swami started giving maximum importance, as you're saying, to the message, was maybe in that period of 32 when, as we're saying, another important figure enters Swami's life in this year, 1948.
Yes, Shri Kasturi.
Important figure for us.
Correct. For Swami, everyone are equally important.
Right.
But in terms of documenting Swami's history, Shri Narayan Kasturi, he got the privilege of entering Sai's fold in 1948. We will come to that also. The other, or the most, if we can say the most important event of 1948, was the beginning of the construction of the Prashanthi Nilayam Mandir as we know it today.
Right. What was happening is we've seen that 1947, Swami started traveling. So as Swami started traveling, more people started visiting Swami. As these festivals of Dashara and birthday and, you know, Vaikuntha Ekadashi was a very special festival then.
When Swami would materialize a vessel with Amrit, right?
Right. And Swami would, and it, sometimes very fascinating, Swami would pull out that vessel from under the sands in Chitravati. But still there would be Amrit in that and there would be not a grain of sand sticking either to the vessel or to Swami's hand. So these events started drawing more people, and the more people started coming in, more discomfiture for Swami. You know, the kind of facilities which Swami had in Parthi was very less, and even the devotees were inconvenienced. So I think it was Sakama who suggested that Swami should in fact shift to Bangalore. She offered to build an ashram for Swami in Bangalore.
You know, it is so many things start coming, bubbling from within, having seen all that happens in 1948. It's only after we talk and discuss the whole 1948 can we see the connections. You know, Sakama's desire that Swami should spend time in Bangalore, you know, Swami apparently being sick and spending 3-4 months at her home. But at the same time, Ishwaramma has elicited a promise from Swami that he would not leave Puttaparthi whatever happens. Sakama wants to build an abode for Swami. All these come together and a beautiful year 1948 sprouts. So if we have to start 1948 right from the very beginning, one of the first things that happened in 1948 is, as you said, many devotees started coming to Swami. Among these devotees were also devotees from the royal families.
Right.
It was on the 8th of January 1948 that the queen, the Maharani of the kingdom of Sandur. Sandur was a small kingdom that's located somewhere in between the current day Andhra Pradesh and Karnataka states. So, if I may be allowed, a small detour into the history.
In the current map, I think it comes around in the Bellary district region.
Correct. Yes. Even there's a town called Sandur also.
Right.
And I think the Sandur Palace has been converted into a 4-star hotel or a 3-star hotel.
Okay.
Today, that's what happens to most of the palaces. They get because in that way, there are funds to maintain. At the same time, right. Some sections people, feel royalty. Get the chance to get a feel of royalty.
And people staying in that hotel will have no idea that Swami himself had stayed in that place sometime back.
Yes. That happened in 1948, but that was later.
Much later, right.
Before that, I think it was the queen. The queen, her name was Sushila Devi Ghorpade.
Okay, that was a family name.
The Ghorpade. Now, that is an interesting history, actually. Mm-hmm. In the 15th century, I don't know if it's 1470 or 1460, that was the time when the Marathas were coming. The Marathas, who are famously known after the emperor, after the King Shivaji.
Right.
These Marathas, they were ruling in Maharashtra region, and
Shivaji Swami speaks so highly of him and his mother Jijabai more.
Exactly. He gives, there are at least 3 Chinnakathas based on Shivaji, I think.
Right.
One is with Jijabai, one is about that frog in the stone.
With Samarth Ramdas.
Samarth Ramdas, his guru. Well, those are, but you can't help that. And so, while talking about Swami, so many things crop up. That's what I was saying. So, during those times when the Marathas were ruling a large part of central India, there was also the Bahamani kingdom to the south of the Maharashtrian kingdom. At that time, there were 2 brave generals.
Okay.
Now, these 2 brave generals, they are actually the forefathers of this Ghorpade family.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how they got this name Ghorpade is because these 2 generals, one was Karan Singh and the other was Bhim Singh.
Mm-hmm.
I think they are named after the 2 Pandavas, Karna and Bhima.
Okay.
So, Karan Singh and Bhim Singh, they had to capture the fort of Vishaldurg. Now, the fort of Vishaldurg was an impregnable one because on one side was the main gate, which is heavily guarded, and there are even cannon shells and other mortar guns to guard that. The other side is a steep cliff, natural obstacle against any army.
Right. That's how they used to build forts those days.
On top of the hill. So this Vishalgarh fort, it exists even today. So if we visit it, you can have a look at how difficult it must have been in those times to conquer it without helicopters, flying planes or anything like that. At that time, the General Karan Singh came up with a brilliant plan.
Mm-hmm.
He said the only way to attack them is from the behind. That is to climb the hill into the fort. They wondered, that is okay, that's a good thing, but how do you climb? He brought a monitor lizard. Now, the monitor lizard is known for its grip, the way it can grip. And it can even scale vertical walls.
Mm-hmm.
So they say that he used a monitor lizard tied to a rope, which goes up.
Right, there are so many legends about this,
Correct.
They tie a rope to it, throw it up, and that grips the wall.
That grips the wall, and with the help of that, soldiers climb up, one or 2 soldiers. Then the soldiers secure the rope and let down for the rest of the army to climb up.
Wow, okay.
And in Marathi, this monitor lizard in that region, locally, it's called Ghorpad.
Oh.
It's called a Ghorpad. And because of that, because he used the Ghorpad to achieve a phenomenal, unbelievable victory, Karan Singh's family and generations after that, Karan Singh did not actually have children who became rulers.
Mm-hmm.
It was his brother Bhim Singh. And the rulers of Sandur were all descendants from Bhim Singh, not Karan Singh. But from then on, they were given the family name Ghorpade. Because they made use of the Ghorpads to achieve in memory of that famous, unbelievable victory and bravery that was shown by these princes.
Okay.
Yeah, so they have been named as Ghorpade. In fact, they trace their origins back to the Sisodia Rajputs of Rajasthan.
Okay.
So, in 1948, the king at Sandur was Srimad Yashwantrao Hindurao Ghorpade.
Mm-hmm.
So, his wife, that is the queen we are talking about, Sushila Devi Ghorpade, she came to know about Swami from another member of the royalty, which was the Aras family in Mysore.
Right.
That is royalty at Mysore.
Okay.
The family still exists. In fact, one M.Y. Aras, if I remember, he was also the chief minister for the state of Karnataka for a brief period.
Okay.
So, it is the royal family. So, from then, she got to know that Swami would be coming to Bangalore, and it Swami is a personality that she must visit. And yeah, that's
interestingly,
how.
I think even before she comes to know of Swami, she has that interesting dream where sees Shirdi Baba and Swami, and she is really wondering, you know, who is this person who is coming in the dream. And also, that was a time when they were going through what the other monarchies were going through, the prospect of losing their whole kingdom to this newly formed republic.
Yes, 1947, India had not become a republic
still. It was
India was an independent nation.
Right. So there was this talk of, you know, acquiring the monarchies from these kings. So this was also a small kingdom which was going through that phase and of uncertainty. So that was the time when Swami comes in this dream of this queen. And a friend immediately calls her and says that, you know, so-and-so is coming to my home. You should come and see him.
Hmm.
And I think that is the event happens. That is a very powerful moment. She goes, and the first moment she sees Swami, when they stand on the doorstep to welcome Swami, she sees and she feels that he is God. You know, that's a very powerful moment. And
that's a very great blessing also, Prem.
Right.
To be able to recognize divinity the moment you set your eyes on him. And you know, I was just thinking, if we look at the pictures that are in front of us right now, look at Swami. When we came to Swami, how Swami was, I mean, he had that Swaminess about him, right? He had that something we felt, oh, he's not an ordinary person. But if you look at the photos of those days, it looks like any other ordinary person apart from his seemingly weird hairstyle, what devotees used to call it like that. I mean, what newcomers would call it as the Afro style with a partition in between, you know. So, in no way when you look at him physically, he looks like divine or anything like that. In such circumstances when, you know, Maya is apparently at its highest, because, you know, physically, no way does this personage appear divine. In such circumstances, if the Rani of Sandur was able to just look at Swami and feel it in her heart that this is God, it is really the merit of so many births.
Exactly. You know, and Swami sings in that Telugu song, Tanavari Gurutimpa Tarali Vache. You know, he says, I have come to recognize those people who belong to me. The blessing which Swami gave is he also gave the opportunity to those who belong to him to recognize him. You know, that's what happened with this queen. The moment she saw Swami, she knew that.
And you know, Swami gave her an example of his omnipresence, his omniscience, I mean. In the sense that even though she did not state what was bothering her, that Sardar Vallabhai Patel had set about the amalgamation of states, and the kingdom of Sandur might now get amalgamated into different Indian states, which might not be beneficial for the people.
Right.
By the way, I must mention that if we look at the chronicles of Sandur in the internet or in the history mm-hmm. books of Sandur, you know, Sandur was a very, very well-ruled kingdom.
Oh, okay.
The subjects were all very happy. The kind of governance that they were subjected to was simply wonderful. And that was the thing, you know, that is what the subjects were resisting this amalgamation with an Indian nation, because they said that our king and queen are so wonderful. We don't want to be ruled by anybody else. We want to be ruled by our own king and queen. You know, but for the sake of governance, it had to be amalgamated. So this was the problem. And this was the worry. More than, you know, there were some of those princes and kings who were worried that, you know, our kingdom would be lost.
Mm-hmm.
The queen and the king of Sandur, their worry was, will our subjects continue to be prosperous and happy even after this amalgamation? They were worried about the subjects. And, you know, that I feel is indeed a noble worry. And Swami calmed her immediately. Swami told her, Amma, you don't worry about your state. It is going to become 100 times bigger than it is now. You know, the way Swami put it, it was not as if Sandur will become part of Karnataka. It was as if Karnataka itself is now going to become a part of Sandur. That is the way Swami put it to her and told her, you don't worry, your kingdom is not going to get broken. It is going to become 100 times bigger than what it is now.
It's really beautiful because in a discourse which I was hearing sometime back, you know, mm-hmm. Swami makes this statement. He said, see, if you are going to be happy with the good tidings which happen to you, then your happiness will be limited. But if you are prepared to be happy with the nice things that happens to people all around you, then you can be happy always.
Exactly.
You know, that's a rephrasement of what Swami is telling here, because Swami is telling, as long as you think that this kingdom belongs to you, then you're only the ruler of this kingdom and only this belongs to you. But if you're ready to look at this entire country which is going to be yours, then as Swami said, your state is going to become 100 times bigger.
No wonder that Swami used to always say that, I'm always happy. Because anybody and everybody's happiness is his happiness.
Right.
Really, what a beautiful, like, practical example of expansion love. You know, one of the ways to inculcate expansion love in our lives is to rejoice at others' joys.
And also, what a beautiful imagery this is. Because Swami was showing that what you think is yours is going to be taken away from you, and what is actually yours is going to come to you. And that's what Swami did to these people. Their kingdoms were taken away, I mean, in a political sense, but they found Swami in the process.
They found the kingdom of God.
They found the one who really belongs to them.
Beautiful. In fact, that was the very next statement. You know, after Swami assured her, telling that it will become 100 times bigger than what it is, Swami told her, come to Puttaparthi with the Maharaja. Now, this evoked mixed feelings in the Rani, because the first part of the statement made her happy. Come to Puttaparthi with the Maharaja, because with the Maharaja brought some worry to her, because, you know, the Maharaja, he was not a believer in Babas and Swamis and all that. Usually we see that is almost, I should not make a generalization, but if we have a look at it on a large scale, it is the women who are drawn to spiritual subjects faster than the men. It appears so like that, because in two or three more royal families that we will see, it is the same case that the women got drawn first and then came the men. So she was worried about it, but that she felt that if Swami has called, he has to make it happen, and she had her confidence and faith that is anyway bound to happen. So with that she left, and immediately after she left to her kingdom, back to Sandur.
I think before that she also invited Swami to visit her residence in Bangalore.
Yes.
And I think Swami did that also. Swami visited her house.
Mm-hmm.
And that's after which she returns to her kingdom, and Swami also returns to Puttaparthi after that.
And that is when, you know, Swami returns, we can say that Swami returns to his kingdom, because this was going to be the beginning of his kingdom. Let me put it this way. Once it so happened that, you know, the Chitravati river was in spate, and because the river was in spate, it began to flow even into the village of Puttaparthi. So much so that on one occasion, it came even into the Pathamandiram.
Mm-hmm.
And all the tins of oil and rations and everything were floating on the water. You know, these were the rations that were to be used to cook food for the devotees. And since they were floating in the water, you know, everybody felt that the mandir is not apparently safe and secure enough against these elements. What if the flood comes again? So that was one of the reasons when, you know, some of the devotees began to seriously contemplate on a bigger and better mandir for Swami. At the same time, here was Doddamane Sakamma, who had thought about this, you know. She wanted to, as you said, she wanted to build a ashram for Swami in Bangalore, which had all facilities to take care of the devotees.
Right. And in fact, one of the reasons why she thought of Bangalore was, it was so difficult to procure a land in Puttaparthi, because people were still not accepting that idea that here is a little village boy who grew with us, who now is claiming
being hailed
so
as the Lord of the universe.
Right.
So therefore, if you see, at that time, that point in time, the Pathamandir itself, as we discussed, was on the outskirts of the village.
Yes, just in the fringe.
It was just outside the village. Doddamane Sakamma finally wanted to buy a piece of land. She bought it way outside the village. You know, way outside the village.
She buys, I think, 3.86 acres of land.
Yes.
For an exorbitant price of 5,000 rupees.
That time it was indeed exorbitant.
And she had to do that because nobody else was ready to sell their land
Correct.
For the purpose of Swami's mandir.
Correct. You know, in order to get an idea of how exorbitant it was, if we go back, remember the land for the Patha Mandir, which was procured in 1945,
right.
Was done so by Karanam Subbamma and Karanam Kamalamma for a price of rupees 50.
Okay.
Rupees 50 that was. Now, here was a land. It also gives an idea of the amount of land she brought.
Right.
Bought. A huge piece of land worth 5,000, which is 100 times costlier than the land that had been bought just 3 years ago. So that was the kind of land that Doddamane Sakamma bought. And you know, there's a beautiful document. If you don't mind, I would just read out what is there in the document. This document number 860, when Doddamane Sakamma bought the piece of land, it says that executed in favor of Srimati D. Sakamma, the Seva Parayani. You know, that was her title.
She was given the title by the Mysore Kingdom, is it?
I think she was...
She was also honored by the British government also.
By the British government as Kesar-e-Hind.
Right.
And by the Mysore Kingdom as Seva Parayani. Seva Parayani means one who is devoted to service. And Kesar-e-Hind means the jewel of India. Because of her charitable activity, she was known like that. In fact, I think she even joined the Royal Mysore Assembly in the Mysore Kingdom for governance.
Right. I mean, it also speaks about the progressive society which was then, you know, quite contrary to what we believe, that here is a woman who could achieve such things in the society.
And she was a devotee of Swami. Yeah. It's not as if only the ignorant and misled were coming to Swami. The highest and highest education and were being considered as the greatest intellectuals of that era, they were the ones who were actually coming to Swami. We will see some more. We will come across Tirumala Iyengar and others also later on. But here it says that the third wife of Chinna Basappa, the resident of Baswanagudi in Bangalore, in the sub-registrar's office between 12 p.m. to 1 p.m., paying a requisite fee of 80 paisa, that is the registration fees for the document, the executors of the registered sale deed have received an amount of 3,000 on the 12th of September 1946 through the deed agreement, with the remaining amount of 2,000 to be received in the presence of the sub-registrar at the time of execution of the sale deed. And then the deed defines the boundaries for the property. On the east, that is where we see the main road that leads to the main entrance of Prashantilayam. It is said on the east, the cartway towards Enumalapalli. So there was no road and it was just a clearance. Some bushes had been cleared so that carts could go. So that cartway formed the eastern boundary. And on the west and north, there was a Kadiyala Thimmappa. He had agricultural lands. So Kadiyala Thimmappa Zameen. And in between, and towards the north also, there were the lands of so many farmers. So embedded in between these farmlands was this land that Sakamma bought. And it was in her possession for almost a year.
So it also gives us an idea that place which we see as the Gopuram Road and that main road between Gopuram and the old Mandir would have been farmlands.
Exactly. So it was, you know, way outside the village.
Right.
It's about 200 meters away from the Patamandir. And Patamandir itself is outside the village. So you can see how they outcast Swami actually. But today we have a look. The village, we think where the Puttaparthi is ending, that is actually the beginning of the village. You know, the new Puttaparthi has come into being. And she held on to this land for a year, after which she gave it to Swami.
Right.
She wanted to donate it to Swami. And again, you know, she made another document in that she stated that for the self-satisfaction of my husband and myself, I have handed over the site which I have acquired out of the income that we have received from our tea estates at Bangalore. So, at the sub-registrar office, Bukkapatnam, with absolute rights to sell and donate at your free will and to utilize the property for any of the following purposes. She stated her intent behind giving the land. She said, one, to construct the ashram and related constructions on the property, to lease out the property to good farmers and deposit the lease rent until such a time when construction of bhajan mandirs and residential flats becomes possible. So she said the land could be utilized for agriculture till a decision was taken to build bhajan mandirs. She thought multiple mandirs will be coming up and flats for accommodation of devotees. Another important point, you see, what we see today as a practice in Prashantilayam apparently had been embedded back then.
Right.
I will read it out, you will understand what I am talking about.
Exactly.
That on the scheduled property, the construction of residential flats for the use of devotees of Sri Sathya Sai Baba should be only with your permission, referring to Baba's permission only. But such devotees in whose favor the residential flats are constructed will not have any right in whatever manner over the scheduled property afterwards. And we see that happening even today, you know, all the apartments and flats that have been allotted to different people in the mandir, it is theirs, you know, as long as they are physically alive. It is not ancestral. It is not automatically given to their children after their passing.
Right.
So, sometimes it seems strange, but this was a thing that had been executed by Sakama in 1948. And, you know, Swami has stuck to the legalities of and the condition that she set. Then the third thing she had requested was the foundation stone should be laid as quickly as practicable. With that, she offered this land completely to Swami in 1947.
And then after Swami received that land, Swami did not wait even for a few years or so, because Swami immediately started making plans. And there is that very interesting event, which is similar events that happened in previous years also. Swami was sitting in the Chitalti sand, and Swami was drawing the plans for this Prashanthi Nilayam Ashram. Where Swami was saying that this is where the mandir will come and the bhajan all. And Swami even went on to say East Prashanti, West Prashanti, South Prashanti.
And which made no sense to people then.
No sense to people. And in fact, Swami said, a day will come when people will come from all corners of the world. And some devotees who were, you know, present when Swami was making such revelations, very regretfully say that they even laughed, sneered at Swami and laughed, even though they were the devotees and they were not the you know, doubters then. But still they said the atrociousness of this prophecy made
audacity
them laugh,
of that,
you know.
Prophecy.
They said, how can Swami say that the world is going to come? People take 24 hours to come here from Bangalore, you know, the nearest city. And Swami is saying the people from all corners of the world will come. And Swami went on to say that then you will not be able to see even my hair. That's how far I will be. And that was a prophecy which most of them lived to see, I think.
Prem, you know, when you made this, observation, I was just thinking, you know, those devotees, now they regret, some of them, saying that when Swami said a time will come when you'll struggle to see a speck of my robe, a little of my hair, they all laughed wondering how that can ever happen. I sometimes feel that we too are guilty of this kind of mockery, you know, because I remember a few years back Swami said a time will come when India, China, Japan, Pakistan, all of them will become one. And seeing even today the conditions that exist, it seems most unlikely that this such a thing will ever happen. And we often think that, you know, what is Swami speaking? It's not as if we don't believe him. It's not as if we are not devotees. But in spite of that, you know, that complete acceptance of the master, somehow I don't think I have that. You know, it's so lacking. Maybe this is a, these are, when we read such episodes, they remind us that let us remember about whom we are talking. And let us remember that how much ever we try, we will never be able to comprehend even an iota of his magnificence and power. And that every word, every breath he speaks is true. So let us not take anything lightly what he has said. Let us take everything seriously. It's just a matter of time, because it has been proved over and over many times before in the past that, you know, even when he said that this is the drawing of the mandir that is going to come up, seeing the scale and size of the drawing itself, people wondered why. Even Swami's own bodily mother apparently later on asked him, Swami, why are you building such a big mandir? Where will you get people to fill this? You know, if she had seen that the stadium, outdoor stadium, was insufficient to accommodate devotees, so much so that the whole event had to be broadcast and telecast live, and about 80 to 90,000 people from around the world logged in to view it live, almost deferred live, you know, maybe she would have got an idea of what is the kind of crowds that came to see Swami.
Absolutely, and I think it was all part of the game, where Swami would give things which were so unbelievable and then let the history reveal itself and then floored you by the very grandeur of the flow of events.
Speaking of Swami would give things so unbelievable, I'm reminded, you know, before we go off into the new mandir that's being constructed, one or two episodes that took place in the Pathamandir, unbelievably profound ones, In fact, I remember one of them has been documented even in our video documentary entitled The Advent. And it would be apt, I think, at this point to just play that little audio clip. Of course, though we are not able to view the video, the audio in itself with the sound effects will give us an idea of this episode that took place in the Pathamandir.
Because you will hear the voiceover in English, but in the background you can hear the voice of Mrs. Vijay Kumari, the author of Anyatashadam Nasti, who was present when this event happened.
She
was present during many of the events which happened in 47, 48.
When we record an interview with her, she narrated these episodes. Yes.
So we listen to that small clip from this year, the
Advent.
The documentary named The Advent.
Incredible were the leelas that the Lord performed during the Pathamandiram days. Not many had the good fortune of seeing them, but among the blessed few who did, some have recorded for posterity what they saw. One such is Mrs. Vijay Kumari, who at the time she witnessed these incredible leelas of God was a young girl. Those leelas made a deep impression on her. And even now, 60 years later, she is able to relive every single one of those precious moments. One day in 1946, we were all seated around Swami in the Pathamandiram. There was a huge pile of tulsi leaves, and Swami asked us to make garlands with them. In fact, he himself started making a garland. That was the first time we saw him make a garland, and the speed with which he worked was amazing. All of a sudden, Swami said, "Listen, Ganga Mata is coming. Get up and let us all go and see her." Although Swami got up and moved forward, we did not believe what he said. We just covered our mouths and started laughing. Where is Ganga and where is Puttaparthi? Thinking thus, we continued to sit and didn't budge. But when Swami started to go quickly towards the main gate, we immediately followed. Swami went out of the main gate and stood there. Stretching his hands wide on either side, he said, "Nobody should cross this limit. All of you must stand behind." We did as told, wondering, "Swami, where is the Ganga you were talking about?" Just then Swami said in an excited voice, "Look there, she's coming." Suddenly we heard the roar of massive waves and saw a huge torrent of water rushing towards us with great speed and tremendous force. Scared to death, we feared that we would all be drowned by this deluge. I, along with other children, then caught hold of Swami tightly. Swami told us to remain silent and watch Mother Ganga. As the water approached us, Swami stretched forth both his hands in a gesture of benediction. And most miraculously, the surging water became calm where we were. But beyond that area, the water was still roaring and turbulent. Addressing the waves, Swami said, "Ganga, we are very happy that you have come here all the way from Kailash." Turning to us, he said, "Mother Ganga has come all the way from Kailash and you are not even doing puja? Run and get kumkum, turmeric, flowers and some coconuts and perform puja." We rushed inside, brought with us all the required articles and did the puja as instructed. Swami himself broke the coconuts and offering them to the river before us said, "Ganga Mata, we are so happy that you could come here." He then blessed her and asked her to return. Even as he was instructing her, she vanished completely. She was gone as mysteriously as she came. A moment earlier, there was a torrent of water, But now, most amazingly, there was absolutely no sign of even wetness anywhere. We then prayed to Swami to go back inside the mandir. However, Swami continued to stand there and told us to look at his feet. When we did, we found a garland of jasmine flowers around them. The surprising part was that each flower was as big as a ball. The fragrance was superb and the garland was very well made. Swami asked us to pick up the garland and hand it over to him, telling us that these flowers were from Kailash, which was why they were so big. Swami then removed the flowers one by one and distributed them. Our family also got a flower, and we kept it safely until the flower gradually dried up.
There's no words which we could add to that description. And, you know, I've seen that video, Arvind, where she narrates this thing. You can see the whole scene coming alive in her eyes when she's narrating that incident. And she was merely a small girl when this thing happened. And I also remember another incident she narrates in the same period. You know, she was talking about making tulsi garlands, because that was a time when the other pastime, apart from doing bhajans, was to make garlands for Swami. Because Swami was very fond of flowers.
Even so all the ladies would participate in that.
All the ladies would sit around in a group and make garlands. And Swami would come in and join sometimes. So one day when they were making these tulsi garlands, Swami came in and said, "Hey, let's have a game." He said, "Let's see who can make a garland which is as long as my, equal to my height." To put it that way. He said, "It should be exactly equal to my height." So everybody started making garlands. And Swami also sat and started making a garland. And they would come and measure Swami. They would ask Swami to stand, measure with the thread.
Oh my God.
And start making those garlands. But it would
happen. Measure it with the thread, right?
Right. And every time, how many other times they would measure and make the garland, it would either be short or long. That was something some mischief Swami was doing. Then even as Swami was talking to them and saying that, no, your garland is not, you know, good enough, Swami himself made a garland, and that was done without any measurement, and it was perfectly to Swami's height.
Wow.
But by the time this game had ended, they found that they'd had a huge heap of a tulsi garland made. So they wondered what to do with this all this garland now. And Swami said, "Okay, you give me all the garlands." And then Swami started tying them into a ball. So made them into a real tight tulsi football, or whatever you could call that.
Okay.
And then Swami said, "Okay, all the ladies come to one side, all the men folk come to one side."
So there were men also involved in this competition.
Right. I mean, I don't know whether they were involved in the competition, but the game after that, Swami invited them to. So then Swami started throwing this ball to each one of them, and they would throw it back to Swami. And, you know, a game like that was going on, and they had no clue how long they played that game. It looked like they played for a very short time because they were having a lot of fun. But after the game was over, the way they were gasping for breath and they were feeling a kind of a heaviness in their head, that's when they realized that they had played for so long. And so when they sat and they started discussing with each other that we seem to have played for so long and all that. And then one of the people who were playing there, he said, "But I wonder why Swami was playing only with me. He was all the time throwing the ball only to me." And immediately another person said that, you know, how can that be? Because Swami was playing only with me. And I was feeling, why is Swami playing only with me? And then they realized that each one felt that way, that Swami was playing ball game only with them.
Wow.
And then when they were wondering what had actually happened and this heaviness in their head, they were feeling a kind of happiness which they had never experienced before, and this weird feeling of Swami having played with each one of them, Swami came by and said that, "You silly ones, you don't realize that I actually played the Rasa Krida with you."
Wow. You know, Krishna had simultaneously danced with each of the Gopikas in the Dwapara Yuga as proof of his all-pervasiveness in the universe. And that is what exactly the devotees at Pata Mandir had also experienced on that day. That rare joy, that supreme bliss that made them feel as if they were floating in the air in spite of them being so tired and fatigued. You know, that sweet thought of being one with the Lord that is what actually had frenzied them into such happiness,
right,
that they had forgotten their bodies and their fatigue and everything. You know, at the same time, there's one more beautiful parallel with the Krishna avatar in this story. You were talking about how they were all trying to make a garland that would match Swami's height. You know, there's a story of Mother Yashoda being annoyed with Krishna being so naughty. So she decides that she will tie him up to a place at home so that he doesn't go about doing his mischief.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, she goes and she gets a rope. She sees that it is not long enough to tie Krishna. And then the next rope she gets, she sees that it is too long and it may envelop her little Krishna. After all, he's a little child and he should not get, you know, overlapped with so many ropes. So it's too long. Then the next rope is too short. It goes on for a long time and she's not able to get a rope that is good enough, long enough, yet not very short so that it can tie Krishna, till Krishna himself smiles and allows himself to be tied. You know, in that, the message that that story gives is that you cannot bind the Lord. The Lord should allow himself to be bound by you. And the Lord will allow himself to be bound to you only when he receives your love and devotion. So I think in a way that too was the same message here also, that how much ever you try, you take the measurement. I was just picturing, even as you were telling, you know, picturizing that image of Swami sitting in a place and a lady coming and stretching out a thread from the top of his hair till the tip of his toe to get the exact measurement so that she can win the prize, only to get disappointed later on that her garland is either short by 1 inch or it's longer by 1 inch. Really, what beautiful leelas.
And you know, see that contrast, Arun, you know, it's so beautiful. One side, Swami is assuring the royalty of their welfare, and you know, people are coming to him with very serious issues, political issues, family issues. Swami is curing people, Swami is solving family problems. The other end, Swami is doing things like this. Swami is just a playful child, because there are other descriptions of things which Swami used to do. Swami would go for, you know, that Chitravati session where Swami would suddenly vanish, Swami would jump out from a boulder, and Swami would say, let's race and run with the children. So many beautiful things. And I think there's another couple of beautiful incidents which will come later, in even in this year 1948, where people were wondering, is this the Lord who has come to, you know, give us succor, or is this the Lord who is, you know, just come to play with us? You know, what is he? That was the feeling people would have been left with.
In the meantime, you know, yeah, we went back to the Pathamandiram days to relive those two beautiful episodes. In the meantime, we were talking about how, you know, the new mandir was, Swami had decided upon getting a new mandir constructed. There are some very interesting facts about the construction of this new mandir. And one thing is, the foundation stone laying ceremony for this mandir was done on the 14th of January, 1948. Now, 14th of January every year is Shankranti.
Right.
And it is very significant that such an opening happened on the Shankranti day. Swami himself explains the meaning of Shankranti. He says, it is from the Shankranti day that the sun begins its northward travel, or the Uttarayanam as it is called. And he says that the significance of the sun moving northward means that this is a very wonderful time for one's mind to move Godwards. Because Swami says, towards the north in India are located the Himalayas, which are considered as the abode of the Lord. In fact, if we go to the state of Uttarakhand, the state of Uttarakhand is called Daiva Bhumi, Deva Bhumi, because the Himalayas come there.
Okay.
You know, it is considered as the land of gods. So Swami says, since the sun moves northwards, which is towards the Himalayas, this means that anybody who is contemplating on growth spiritually should start activities on this day, on the Sankranti day. And in fact, it is for this day that even the great grandsire of the Mahabharata, Bhishma, waited before giving up his body, because he felt that his spirit would also rise in the spiritual realms.
He had the boon of Ichha Mrityu.
That giving up his life whenever he wished
to.
So he chose this day. Isn't it very significant that Swami chose this very same day, a day on which everybody is, you know, prescribed to turn their minds towards God? He chose this day to lay the foundation stone for the Prashanti Nilayam.
Indeed, because even Sankranti, Swami would say that it means a change for the good. That's what Swami would say.
Krantī. Krantī meaning
Kranti
progress.
Meaning progress or change. And Sankranti means good change.
Sam means good, yes.
Yes. You know, indeed, it's a very special day to choose this. And another interesting fact about the plans for the mandir. Interestingly, there is a Shivaji theater in Bangalore.
Oh, yes.
Which is a very famous theater.
I was about to come to it because it was there till about 6-7 years ago.
Oh, is it?
It was demolished recently. I have even got a few photographs of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was at that time the center of Bangalore.
Okay.
There is a town hall. Then there is a Ravindra Kalakshetra,
okay,
which is supposed to be the area for auditorium for performing arts.
Okay.
Even to this day, all the drama troupes and other such, you know, maestros who play music maestros, they consider it an honor and privilege to give a performance at Ravindra Kalakshetra.
Okay.
So there was the town hall, the Ravindra Kalakshetra, and just over there is this Shivaji theater.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was called Shivaji Takis. And though it became dysfunctional about two, three decades ago, the building at least remained till about 5 years ago. And that's why, you know, when I came to know about this fact, I was so thrilled.
I think we have not yet let the fact out.
Yes, that's what I'm building up the suspense for that. Yes, you take the honor of letting the fact out.
Yeah, interestingly, the plan for the old mandir was based on the dimensions of this Shivaji Talkies.
And Swami was impressed with the facade of the Shivaji Talkies.
The elevation.
He wanted exactly the same. So the exact same measurements of Shivaji Talkies were taken to build the first Prashanti Mandir. And you know, today what we have is a totally different kind of Prashanti
what
Mandir.
What it was built initially.
The balcony and all is different. Those days, you know, there was a Krishna statue in the balcony. It was like a huge bungalow.
Right.
And now, you know, after having come to know of this, when I look back, yes, there is a large resemblance between the Shivaji Talkies and Swami's first Mandir.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting, and no one knows why, but the Lord chose the Shivaji Talkies as the model for building the Prashanti Nilayam Mandir.
Right, and it seems the measurements were almost as precise
same,
and accurate
the
as
same,
same
Shivaji
size. Talkies. And more interesting than this were the kind of people who were involved in the construction of the Mandir.
Mm.
And it is needless to say that Swami had handpicked some of these people who were involved. And one legendary figure who was involved was a person whom you mentioned, Tirumala Iyengar.
If it was Tirumala Rao for the Pata Mandir, for the new Mandir it was Tirumala Iyengar,
who was the senior architect.
And engineer also.
Right, and he was a very great man. His name was associated with some of the world famous projects which were taken up in India.
Much later on they were taken up.
Yes. But he was known for his acumen in the field of engineering and architecture.
Exactly. In fact, you know, between 1944 and 1952, even as he lent his expertise and his devotion and dedication to building the first mandir for, not the first, the big Prashanti Nilayam Mandir for Swami, he was also at that time in charge of the Tungabhadra Dam project.
Right.
Even to this day, the Tungabhadra Reservoir exists. It's a gigantic reservoir measuring about 6,000 feet in length, about 160 feet in height. And it was Tirumala Iyengar who was involved in building this Tungabhadra Dam. And later on, he was also associated with the building of the Hirakud Dam.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Hirakud Dam is the largest dam in India even to this day. And, you know, it shows the stature of Tirumala Iyengar. And it was such a person who was heart, body, mind and soul into building Swami's Prashanti Nilayam.
And if he was the person who was going to be the senior architect, the material for the mandir came from all around the place. You know, just to give you an idea of that, before we come to that, I think we should talk about the main substance which was used to make the mandir.
No cement. Hmm.
No, even before that, Swami had said that he wants the building to be built in granite.
Hmm.
And I remember, you know, when we had spoken to one of Swami's devotees in those early years, and also a person who belonged to the Ratnakar family, Mr. Kishtapa, he is still around, very revered old person. By bodily relation, I think he is Swami's cousin.
Mm.
He was sharing with us this beautiful incident of how they found the granite to build this mandir.
Because you need quite a lot of granite, right?
You know, you can imagine, Swami drew the plans based on Shivaji Theater. It must have been a huge building. So they came up to Swami and said, Swami, if we have to transport this much of granite from the nearby places, it's going to be very difficult. So then Swami said, it seems that you go to this particular region in Chitravati and you look for granite there. So there was a small slab of granite. You know, that place, when Swami would go with the devotees to Chitravati, Swami would sometimes sit on that slab of granite and, you know, have bhajans. Or sometimes after running around and playing, Swami would come and lie down on that granite and rest for a while. But when they went and explored, they found that it was actually a huge granite reserve there. You know, literally a small hillock which was completely a granite.
So the granite slab that was being seen on top was like the tip of an iceberg.
Yes. And when they
underneath.
Yes, when they went and dug up there and excavated, they found that they had more than enough granite right there. They wouldn't have to get it from anywhere else.
In fact, in the book it is mentioned that that single piece of granite measured about 100 feet in length and 60 feet in width. That's really a huge block of granite.
And, you know, after they found the granite, now they went back to Swami and said, Swami, we found the granite, but now we have another problem. How do we break it up? Because it's a huge chunk, one monolith. How are we going to break it up?
And in the 1950 it was, so there would have been no bulldozers or heavy drilling equipment here.
And I don't know about dynamite blasting that time, whether it was possible.
It was possible.
It was
in
possible,
fact, that was Tirumala Iyengar's idea.
Right, it was possible, but the idea was whether it was too close to the dwelling place and whether it could have been a feasible idea to do that.
No, and other thing is, Prem, you know, as Tirumala Iyengar states, that even if they decide to use the dynamite, they will need large quantities of dynamite to break up a rock, a monolith that is of this size.
Okay. So that's when they come back to Swami, and Swami tells them that, go tomorrow and have a look. And that's what Swami says. But do you have any idea which time of the year this construction was going on? I think it must have been in May.
Early in 1948 only.
Still not the summer months?
I don't think
so. In January, she gives the land to... Sakama gives
and
the land to Swami.
The Bhumi Puja is done then. So right, immediately after that, must be about March or April.
So that gives an idea of which part of the year it was.
Yeah, March and April is really... Yeah, summer almost begins.
Right. And when they go back the next morning, the previous night, there's a sudden surprise shower.
Okay.
In the middle of, you know, summer or pre-summer, there's a sudden shower. And one thunder strikes exactly that rock and it's broken it into pieces.
You mean lightning strikes?
Right, I'm sorry. Lightning strikes that piece of rock and shatters it into pieces. And the next morning when they go... You know, the whole thing is scattered all over the place.
No need of your dynamite, no need of your heavy earth moving equipment.
Absolutely. They just pick those stones, shape it as they want, and they use it for the construction.
One more thought here, Prem. You know, when we describe like these, you know, sometimes it happens that in our enthusiasm for factual correctness and being perfect and historical, we sometimes, you know, slightly forget the divine way in which a devotee would describe. When we read the Bhagavatam, Srimad Bhagavatam, in that when Lord Krishna, you know, lifts the Govardhana, it is described as the fulfillment of the dream of the Govardhana hill, you know, because it is said that in the previous birth, the hills were being transported all across the Indian subcontinent. Why? Because Lord Sridharma wanted a bridge to be made across to Lanka. This is a story that, you know, Swami has narrated. And when these stones and rocks were being transported to build the bridge, suddenly message comes that, you know, the bridge is ready. Bridge is ready, bridge is ready. So all the monkeys drop the rocks, stones, hills, wherever they are carrying. And thus the Govardhana hill, which had been chosen to serve the Lord, loses the chance and begins to cry. And it is said that Rama recognizes the plight of Govardhana and promises, saying that, don't worry, you will be an instrument of the Lord. You will be used, your time has not yet come. And it is said that therefore, when he comes as Krishna, he picks up the Govardhana hill to shelter the whole Gokula village from the rain. And Govardhana Giri, that is the hill called Govardhana, rejoices at being given this chance to be a part of the Lord's mission. I was just thinking, those would have been the similar thoughts of the cloud god, of the rain god, of the lightning, and of that granite rock. God knows, you know, what that slab of granite, that huge pile of granite might have been in its previous birth. It might have longed for an opportunity to serve the Lord.
You know, Arvind, I'm really glad that you made that point, because I'm reminded of something very profound which happened with a student. A couple of incidents, to start with the first one, where it always happens between Swami and students. Swami was ignoring one particular student for quite a period of time, definitely for his own good. But that boy was going through that trauma of not having Swami talk to him for quite some time. So when eventually Swami spoke to him one day, he burst into tears and he said, "Swami, what is the point of being in Puttaparthi? You know, if you do not look at us and if you do not talk to us, we are like just the pillar in the rocks over here of your mandir. You know, we are sitting here every day. We are like the
lifeless.
We are like the pillar in the walls. We can claim to be here, but we are not here." You know, that was the sentiment he was trying to express to Swami. Swami was in a very motherly mood and was consoling him. But when Swami heard that, Swami became very serious. He said, "You have no idea how much penance each pillar here has done to be here."
Oh my God.
Now, these were the very words of Swami. He said, "You have no idea what each pillar and rock has done to be here."
And you said a couple of incidents?
Yes, and another one was an interesting dream a friend of mine shared with me. And of course, you could always dismiss it as a dream, but for the person, it's very strong, the imagery with which he shared. The very next day after he got this dream, he came and shared it with all of us. He said, you know, there's a particular place where this boy usually sits in the mandir. And in the dream, he was sitting in that very place. And he was waiting for Swami to come out for darshan. And somehow he felt that the whole mandir, the building, you know, the bhajan hall and the whole building, the central building in the Kulwant hall, he felt it was alive. You know, that was a feeling he felt. And when he looked around, he felt like if you were to be next to a person, you will see that person breathing in and breathing out. You will see that movement in that body, right?
Correct.
That expanding and the contraction. He felt that was happening with the building.
The whole Kulwant hall and the main building.
And in the dream, he was feeling that, oh, this building is actually alive. This is not an inanimate building. That was the thought which came to his mind. And the next thing he did was he put his ear to the wall. You know, he wanted to see whether, is it really alive or am I just assuming this? So he put his ear to the wall. And in that depth of silence, he heard in a very, very beautiful voice, in a very paused and, you know, spread out way, the words, "Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya." The first feeling he felt was, this is not some ordinary building or this one. It is somebody who has actually earned its place.
Earned the penance, earned through penance. It might be a yogi or saint.
So, yeah, you know, when we talk about Govardhana Hill, we don't know the story of some of these things.
Yeah, that is exactly what I felt. You know, we are thinking it as, you know, Swami did this miracle. We always look at it as Swami doing it for the sake of us people. You know, imagine the engineer, we spoke about him, Tirumala Iyengar, him going to Swami and suggesting that we use dynamite. Now, if I don't know exactly, Swami has not revealed it, but if we can just imagine for a moment, imagine that's a yogi there. And that yogi has been pining for being one with the Lord, and that's why Swami has given him the benefit of him lying on him and taking rest, as you said, throughout the years. And now the yogi is crying that, "Swami, you're separating yourself from me." And here is Tirumala Iyengar coming up with the suggestion that, "Why don't we, you know, blast up that rock with some dynamites?" Swami says, "Don't worry," and he does it in his own divine manner. It's a blessing for the clouds, a blessing for the lightning, a blessing for Tirumala Iyengar, a blessing for all the devotees, for they witnessed this miracle. And then a blessing for the rock too. Really, you know, everything about the Lord is so sweet. No wonder Vallabhacharya describes it and says, "Adharam madhuram, nayanam madhuram, vadanam madhuram, hasitam madhuram." Everything about the Lord, his lips, his walk, his gait, his eyes, his hair, everything is so sweet, sweet, sweet. And this story of sweetness will continue. We will be back, dear listeners, after this little break. Be there to catch up with us again, because some more lovely stories are coming up before the end of this afternoon satsang.
Mandir mein tumara hota hai.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You know, just before this break, we were discussing about how blessed was that granite block to have got the chance to constitute Swami's Mandir, the Prashanta Nilayam Mandir. You know, every material that was used, Prem, in the construction of the Mandir, they came from different parts of South India at that time. That in itself shows that every part, every material was chosen. It's not as if, you know, everything was bought in bulk from one place, from a nearby place. For examples, after the rock had been shattered by lightning and it had to be used, stone cutters and workers adept in stone dressing, they came in from Coimbatore. Masons arrived from Bangalore. You know, cement was not used at all to construct the mandir, only a mixture of sand and lime. In the ancient construction style it was used, and that's why, you know, you would have noticed that when we go to the bhajan hall, it's so cool even in summer and it is warm during winter. You know, unlike cement which becomes very cold or very hot very fast, stone and natural substances like lime and sand, they do not. They take some time. That's why they mitigate. They are cool in summer and warm in winter. Apart from that, you know, the Aras family that we spoke about from Mysore, the royal family, they supplied Swami for the construction.
The timber
and the carpenters also.
Right. You know,
the carpenters, they came. And they bought the timber from Bangalore Timber Depot.
Right.
So therefore,
the doors and frames were made in Bangalore and dispatched and transported here.
And Swami was at the helm of affairs all the time. You know, they say that he would walk around with a scarf tied around his head hair, because, you know, if the dust or anything falls, you know how difficult it will be to brush out his
hair. I can imagine maybe Sakama would have told Swami that you better cover your hair.
Yes, you know, because only Sakama used to have those liberties.
Right.
She would take those liberties with Swami. She would treat him like her own son, scold him, and yeah, so as you say, I can imagine that she would have told him to tie the scarf.
So that was how, you know, things were happening, the construction was going on. But around this time, another interesting event happened. I think we mentioned this before, but since we're talking about 1948...
Just a second, Prem. This question you had asked, and therefore, you know, since all this happened before the end of January, I think that even that rock breaking, mm-hmm. what we were thinking, was sometime in January that it happened. January 1948. So definitely not the monsoons in Puttaparthi. It's towards the end of winter that it happened.
Right. Exactly. And we are in the end of January, and another interesting event happened, as we said, we've mentioned this before, but since we're talking about this period, mm-hmm. definitely warrants mm-hmm. a mention. One day towards the end of January, Swami was going out to Chitravati with his devotees, and abruptly Swami returned back to the mandir.
Okay.
In the evening, and locked himself in the room, and he would not speak to anybody. Every now and then he would come out, but would not converse with anybody. But finally at 7:30, when Swami came out, Swami mentioned to the people around that a very great soul has merged in me today.
In fact, somewhere I've read that it's recorded as, you know, Swami did not speak in English. So when Swami said a great soul, he referred it to as Mahatma.
Right.
A great soul, that is, a Mahatma has merged.
That was the giveaway, but not many people actually realized that Swami was talking about Mahatma Gandhi, who had been assassinated in 1948.
On the 30th of January.
And that was precisely the day and the time.
Yes, 5:30 in the evening was the assassination.
And that was precisely the time when Swami was behaving in this weird manner, apparently weird manner. And it was much later, because some of these devotees who used to stay in the ashram, we've spoken about Balapatabi, they used to go to Bukkapatnam once in 2 days to check if there are any posts for Swami or there are any telegrams, and also in the meanwhile pick up a newspaper which would be brought back to the ashram. That was when people would read about the current affairs. And after 2 days, when they saw the newspaper, they realized that precisely at that time and on that day, Mahatma Gandhi had been assassinated.
Oh. And in fact, in Balapatabi's account, he says that Swami also mentioned the name Gandhi.
Right.
Whether he mentioned that or not is still debated, but this much is sure that Swami said about a great soul, a Mahatma, a Mahanatma. And well, when somebody says Mahatma is coming, everybody assumes it to be a holy man, a sadhu or some great personage. Well, it was Swami's way of giving hint about the Mahatma that he was referring to. Indeed, blessed is the father of nation, and just like Shivaji, there are many times that Swami has spoken about Mahatma Gandhi too. And recently also we had our beloved director, that is Professor G. Venkatraman, doing a musing on Mahatma Gandhi and his principles, how they were in line perfectly with Swami's ideals and ideas. So it's indeed a recognition, it's a stamp of approval, if we can say so, given to the great father of the nation by the Lord himself, by the father of the universe.
And during this time happened another interesting event, which was Swami traveled to Kuppam to attend the marriage of Miss Vijayakumari, Miss who is going to become Mrs. Vijayakumari.
Correct. And that was on the 21st of February.
Right.
That marriage was actually scheduled for the 22nd of February, and the muhurtam or the auspicious time was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So they thought that if Swami comes the previous night, he can rest and relax, and then he can, you know, attend the festivities the next day.
Right.
So Swami actually arrived at Kuppam at about 11 o'clock in the night. Became quite late in the night, and everybody were actually worried. In fact, Amarendra and Krishna Kumar, the two sons of Kuppam Radhakrishna, who was responsible for the Kuppam family coming to Swami.
Right.
So they were actually traveling
sent
along
to
with Swami.
To escort Swami.
Yeah, to escort
Kuppam.
Swami.
Right.
And all of them arrived late, and nobody wanted to ask any questions. So that night, you know, it passed with Swami immediately going and sleeping. And next day morning was the wedding. Swami arrived at 12:30 in the afternoon and himself conducted the entire wedding. He created a Mangala Sutra,
the secret medallion which is worn by a woman who is just married.
Yes, as a mark of her marriage with the man. And Swami materialized that, and he gave all of that. And that was the time, you know, in the evening, Swami got off the, you know, there was a special chair for Swami naturally. But Swami refused the chair in the evening. He sat on the floor with all the other guests. And can you believe it, Prem? At the wedding, Swami regaled them with songs.
Yes, in fact, I mean, to give the background, almost in every marriage in those days, there used to be a concert, a classical music program, either an instrumental or a vocal concert.
And they would be devotional in nature,
yes,
unlike
devotional.
The film songs that are played
these days.
Unlike
the ones which we do these days, where you entertain the guests who have come for the marriage, even as each one goes up and wishes the couple with a classical concert like this. And as you describe so beautifully, in that occasion, when Swami was supposed to preside over this whole function, Swami actually sat down to give that concert.
You know, he started off with Mahaganapatim, the famous Carnatic composition. And after that, you know, he sang many kritis composed by Tyagaraja. You know, he sang Rama Ramani Manohara, Rara Ma Inti Daka, Rama Nannu Brovara, and Brocheva Revarura, concluding with, you know, a bhajan that has become very, very popular, which is Rama Kodanda Rama. And in fact, it is said that when he sang the final song, which was Nagumomu, in that there is a line which says, Jagamele Paramatma, which means that the Paramatma, that is the Supreme Lord, is now in the world. And when Swami was singing this, people said that everybody was in tears. An amazing concert of 7-8 Carnatic songs in the divine voice, in the praise of the divine. Oh, what a magical evening it would have been.
You know, I remember when on a later occasion, Swami would often sing these songs even when Swami visited to the Venkatgiri Palace. And Swami would visit them with Ram and Lakshman. They were two famous Carnatic singers. And Swami would sit and sing along with them.
Yes, I think they were twins, B.V. Raman and B.V. Lakshman.
Okay. So one of our students once was listening to that recording of Swami's singing one of those beautiful kritis. There comes a line where it says that "Aa Ramude Nuve Kada." That's what Tyagaraja writes. And when Swami was singing that line, you know, these Carnatic songs, the lines are repeated number of times in different variations. And when that line comes the last time, Swami actually sings, "Aa Ramude Nene Kada."
Oh, wow.
You know, and I mean, going back to this event of Swami performing this marriage, how beautiful it would have been, Swami.
You know, you said that, again, Swami's story is built on like that. You said, "Aa Ramude Nene Kada." In fact, the rulers at Venkatagiri, we will come to that in the 1950s, because that is when Swami went to Venkatagiri. But the ruler at Venkatagiri was a staunch devotee of Lord Rama.
Right.
And in fact, he received the darshan of Swami as the Kodanda Rama, that is the Rama with the bow. So it would have been no surprise for those people when Swami sang "A Ramudu Nene Kada."
But what a fulfillment it is for this devotee whom we all have so much reverence for, Tyagaraja, that the Lord himself comes after so many years and, you know, he so lovingly and with so much joy sings those very compositions which were composed for him. And what a fulfillment for that devotee it is. And to imagine that till the very end, Swami would enjoy Tyagaraja Kirtanas more than he would enjoy anything else sung to him. So, dear listeners, even as we recollect that event of Swami sitting and giving a musical concert, we come to the end of this week's satsang.
But Prem, you know, before I just forget, I just wanted to make one quick point here. We narrated that, you know, when Swami was going to Kuppam, he got very delayed.
Yes, exactly. I mean,
you know, later on, actually, they found out the reason for the delay. Apparently, this Sai Krishna, this mischievous Lord Sai, while traveling in the car, happened to sight some peacocks and deer.
Deers.
You know, deer on the way, because that was all forest land. Sad that it is not like that today. But the forested land, there were some deer and peacocks. Swami gets out from the car and begins chasing them. Oh, so sweet. And then both these brothers, Amarendra and Krishna Kumar, they have no idea where Swami went. They are searching, and it's quite late in the evening and almost early night by the time they locate Swami. And Swami is so happy, like a thrilled child who has had a beautiful time at a fun fair. And he sits back, it's late in the night, so they decide to also stop for some refreshments. And there another interesting episode takes place where, you know, Amarendra eats something very spicy. Andhra is known for its spicy food. And the spicy food, he's feeling it burn on his tongue. And he wants something sweet to erase that, negate that effect. But there's no sweet nearby. Swami tells him to drink water from his bottle. Amarendra refuses, saying that, you know, actually water scientifically that's correct. Yes, water if you drink on after eating a chili, it doesn't wipe out that burn. Because the chemist in me is coming out. The chemistry says that those molecules which cause the feeling of spiciness or hot,
mm-hmm,
they are fat soluble, and that's why they say add ghee or oil, then the spice goes off, but they're not water soluble. So how much ever water you drink, actually it will not wipe out the spice. So when he was saying, Swami insisted on him drinking the water, and he says when he drank, it was not water, but ambrosially sweet liquid. He doesn't know what it was. It satiated, not only comforted him physically, I'm sure it would have comforted him in his spiritual journey too.
The interesting thing was when the other brother picked up the same vessel and drank, it was water again.
And you know, the human mind, the way it puts it, Amarendra later says that, you know, Swami did this without even touching the bottle. He didn't even touch the bottle and it happened. You know, we often think that if Swami touches and something happens, okay, it's fine. But without touching, hey, this is amazing. You know, this is the limitation of the human mind, which it impresses onto others also. Onto the Lord also, I mean. So, that was the reason why Swami was late in traveling to Kuppam. And then that was a very fulfilling wedding at the end of which Swami sang. And I think with that, one of those songs that Swami sang there in his own golden voice, we can...
Sadly, this is not a recording of that event when Swami sang. This is Swami singing a Tyagaraja Kirtana at Venkatagiri, because there they had better equipment and at the wedding of Miss Vijay Kumari, it was a surprise. Nobody was prepared for it,
yes,
right?
Yes, I'm not complaining, Prem. Something is better than nothing.
Yes.
So with this, dear listeners, we offer our humble gratitude and, you know, so much of love to Swami for giving us this beautiful opportunity to live with Him, live in Him, live for Him, relive His glories day by day, sanctifying all our lives, expressing our gratitude at His lotus feet. We would like to leave you with this beautiful melody in Bhagwan's golden voice. at the end of which you will be joined by Brother Chandu with his segment Love to Love.
Rajasamela Rada Vihara Dhimari Valani Kai Dhirigila Sari Ti Dhimari Valani Kai Dhirigila Sari Ti Kamavil Suni Janaka Kamala Panjara Puchiluka Kamavil Suni Janaka Kamala Panjara Puchiluka Kamadin Takadita Radhukamunu Samadin Takadita Radhukamunu Namanam bunani ne nammiti karma me mo kani na vai karuna kalugani de mo niratamu sammane pilatite ravelani kilda Raja Tamela Rada Vihara Karitu Rangamu Noni Karudaiya Nani Goppa Bhagavati Niki Diva Illu Vakili Ledu Ille Sagara Maiye Pavadil Chano Pango Pannagaraja Maiye Kirti Sampada Kaliginani Nikinta Garvamide Kaligino Kalimigaligina Bhaktulanu Kanula Chudani Chudavemo Ramani Pilatite Ravelani Kilda Rajasamela Rada Vihara Govula Gachuta Gopika Vastra Pahari Vagutani Nirugana Pitike Dattukulu Dimuchu Kadu Trupti Nandina Pitike Dattukulu Dimuchu Kadu Trupti Nandina Kanja Chani Nila Ganamu Kavindina Chikke Kani Vada Vagujuno Chikke Kani Vada Vagujuno Yekkada Chuchinanu Neve Akkaraku Raakunna Ninnika Makkuvaka Poochimpadikari Brahmani Pilachite Ravelani Kilda Rajasamela Rada Vihara